It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
This week I chat to Green Party co-leader James Shaw, who is also back in the office this week. James speaks on the recent changes to fast-track the resource consent process and the concerns on lack of public, community and iwi consultations with new projects. He also responds to the criticisms brought up by the Human Rights Commission for the lack of consultation with Māori and in fulfilling a partnership relationship as established in the Treaty of Waitangi in regards to the COVID-19 response. We also speak on the rise of reports of racism to the Human Rights Commission.
Well, it's really good that the Human Rights Commission have published this report, because it does, I think, help to guide our actions in the future. And, you know, I would say that it is absolutely critical that now that we're sort of past the hump of the health response, if you like, the economic response is the next thing that we're going to have to do a lot of work on. And it's absolutely critical that we uphold Te Tiriti in the economic recovery plan. Obviously, we were operating under tremendous time pressures in the kind of, as we went into the whole level four thing. And, it doesn't surprise me if there were errors that happened during that. I think now we've got the opportunity to kind of take stock as we return to some sense of normality to say, okay, let's make sure that the existing inequality that's out there, that we address that, because that's getting highlighted through the pandemic crisis.
A particular point that the Human Rights Commission brought up was a lack of PPE gear for Māori healthcare service providers, and also that the immediate stress and when we went into level four, you know, the stress of that wasn't evenly spread.
No, that is true, and it's true in terms of Māori health. It's also true in other areas as well. So there are other affected communities, and it was patchy across the country geographically. So, you know, again, like I was saying, because we were moving under tremendous time pressures, I think some of the components of the response highlighted sort of an uneven distribution, if you like, depending on types of provider, where you are in the country, where you sit on the socioeconomic kind of spectrum. All of those sort of things really took all of those existing inequalities and threw them into quite stark relief. And so while the report does say there's a lot to commend, it did say both with Te Tiriti and other human rights weren't fully integrated across the response to the pandemic. I think that that's useful to have that highlighted, and I think that that's something that we need to pay attention to.
And currently, what support and what healthcare packages are there for Māori? Because, you know, a difficult thing I was reading about was that Māori had a higher risk of death from COVID-19, and previously we've seen that with 1918 flu as well as the H1N1. So what is being done there?
Yeah, look, the thing about COVID-19, I mean, and as you say, the Spanish flu and kind of similar events, although none obviously as severe as this one, is that where there are inequalities and people are underserved, and where they've got a sort of a poor medical history, because they generally come from low-income families and, you know, don't have access to the greatest medical care in the world, is that they generally fall into a higher risk category. So it's like, you know, the older you are, the more vulnerable you are to COVID-19. And, you know, if you look at the people who have died over the course of the last month and a half, they have pretty much all been older people. And that's not to say that, you know, younger people haven't also, you know, had very bad effects. And in a lot of other countries, there have been, you know, a lot of younger people who have died as well. This is my point about the sort of the existing inequalities getting played out, is that, you know, we have in New Zealand a socioeconomic makeup of the country that does mean that the provision of healthcare and actually the distribution of health is uneven, and Māori and Pacifica communities are particularly at risk, because generally, on average, they are in those lower socioeconomic groups. And so this is what I mean by saying that the existing inequality has been highlighted through through the pandemic, and so it is something. And it, for me, it just reinforces everything that we have been saying for decades, which is that inequality matters. That we do have to, you know, do something about closing that gap to ensure that, you know, everyone is able to not just to kind of have adequate food, shelter and clothing, but also that they're living healthy lives and have access to good health care. Because when something like this does happen, it disproportionately affects people who have not had access to that through their lives.
Moving on to level three and beyond, how is this inequality going to be addressed as businesses start up again? People are going back to work, they're going back to schools.
Well, you know, we're still kind of seeing how it plays out. One of the things that's, I think I might have said this last week, that's really been kind of obvious to me, is that the, you know, the essential workers, the people who we rely on in order to make sure that we continue to be fed when we're in a situation like this, are amongst the lowest paid, you know, people in our society, right? So the kind of, you know, the distribution center workers, the truck drivers, the store packers, the shop assistants, you know, right through to in our medical, you know, healthcare services, there are a lot of people there who are underpaid and undervalued. And so what I am hoping is that as we, you know, we are in for a rocky ride when it comes to people's jobs and livelihoods and things like that. But I think one of the things that I would like to see recognised is the contribution that people make who we now consider essential. But only a couple of months ago, we were arguing about whether or not we should lift the minimum wage to ensure that they actually get paid enough to be able to live week by week.
Something that was talked about before was lifting the living wage. Is that something that's still talked about, is on the table?
Well, the minimum income, what we were doing with the minimum income was increasing it by $1 a year until it reached the living wage. Mm-hmm. The living wage actually isn't a government measure. It's set by a third party organisation. And so, you know, it's not for me to say what level that should be set at, but we are not going to let up on our program of increasing the minimum wage over time.
In a slightly different vein, but the Human Rights Commission also reported a rise in racism. So we saw 30% reported by the Chinese and Asian community, and also 28% reported by the Muslim community. So I was wondering what was being done to address those concerning rates of racism on the rise.
Yeah, look, this is one of the saddest things about the pandemic to me, is that I don't think it's led to a rise in racism. I think it's led to a rise in expressed racism. So it's revealed the racism that's already there, and it's given people an excuse to voice out loud, you know, their kind of pre-existing prejudices. I don't think it's acceptable, and I do think that, as you know, as we put together the program of work for the coming sort of 12 to 24 months, that addressing racism should be part of the COVID-19 response. And that includes explicit public messaging, because when you see, like, I don't know why anybody in the world listens to Donald Trump about anything, but you know, when he's sort of clearly trying to whip up anti-Chinese sentiment using COVID-19 as the kind of vector, and that just gives permission to bigots to voice their pre-existing attitudes. We've got to stamp it out, frankly.
I think that's very true in saying that your racism has always existed in New Zealand historically, you know, towards the Asian community has always been there. So, I mean, maybe a bit early to say, but what are you hoping to see in terms of structures or things set up, you know, as kids go back to school, as people go back to work in those kind of areas?
Yeah, look, I mean, it is too early for me to say what the government response should be. We're still trying to get through, frankly, putting the country back together after sending it home for a month. And that's obviously occupying a lot of our time and attention. But I do hope that, you know, people do take note of what it is that the Human Rights Commission have said, and that, you know, people who are in positions of authority, whether they're at your university or, you know, places of work or something like that, are just mindful of that and take the opportunity to think about how they can try and mitigate that or you know, where they see it.
Yeah, something else that I saw just pop up this morning was, on a very different subject, there was new legislation approved in terms of how our resource consent was going to be managed. As I saw that the Green Party was critical of the fact that appeal rights would be limited, and there were concerns that it was going to block proper consultation with iwi and environmental concerns.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is an imperfect world that we're living in at the moment, obviously, and we are supporting the legislation through to first reading because we recognise that the time it takes for consents to go through the RMA process mean that there will be projects that, if we were able to move on them sooner, would be able to soak up some of the unemployment that we're about to see. And so we do think that there, you know, there, a case can be made that for the next 2 years maximum, that we might want to be able to fast track some projects, because we do know that during that period of time there will be a lot of people who lose their jobs, and actually we can say, well, look, you know, here are some things that are ready to go. Let's try and make sure that we can actually provide those jobs to people. At the same time, what that means, of course, if you are going to cut the process right back, is that it does, you know, have an effect on your ability to consult the public and engage with iwi and so on. So that is something that we're worried about. That's why we're really keen to see what people have got to say at the select committee hearings about how we might bring that public voice into the process that's being suggested here. I do have to say, I think what I've seen on social media, there's quite a lot of misinformation about what it means. So the expert consulting panels who will be, you know, green lighting these projects have to include relevant local councils. They have to include the relevant local iwi authorities, they have to include experts in resource management, technical project advice, environmental protection, tikanga Māori, mātauranga Māori, and so on. So, you know, and those are all things that the Green Party made sure were in there, including making sure that the bill has, you know, sufficient protections around environmental bottom lines, treaty commitments, and we were really firm on that before we said that we would support it to the stage that it's at.
It'll be interesting to see what happens at the select committee. Obviously, we don't want those very important concerns compromised just for the... I mean, it is important that people are able to get their jobs back, but don't want it to be an imbalance in terms of that.
No, that's right. And it is finely balanced, and I'm confident that we were able to get it into a position where we were able to support it, because eventually when all the, you know, papers come out and so on, what you'll see is that there are some pretty stringent criteria about what kind of projects can be authorised this way, and they have to be able to demonstrate that they, for example, in my own area, that they don't make it more difficult for us to reach our emissions reductions targets in the future. We're not going to be consenting any coal-fired power plants or anything like that. It would never make it off the table. I think that we've done a pretty good job of getting those kinds of things into the bill. Also note that it's only the Minister for the Environment that can actually propose these projects. And so as the Minister for the Environment, you know, David Parker, you know, he's not going to be able to put projects up that directly conflict with his own portfolio area. And that was quite an important thing for us to say, that it's an environmental minister that has the kind of primary say on what projects go forward to these expert consenting panels. Mm. So I do think that it's got a lot of protections in there. The one thing that we are still concerned about is how do the public have a voice when you've got this kind of thing. You know, we need to be aware that it's a pretty kind of privileged position to be able to say, like, if we weren't going to do something like this, about the minimum amount of time that you could greenlight a project is about 9 months under the existing Resource Management Act. That is the exact period of time when we're going to see tens of thousands of people laid out of work. And, you know, to say, well, actually, if you folk could just hold on for the better part of a year whilst we go through our processes to decide whether or not to start a project that could give you a job, that's generally something that people who have got jobs are able to say. And I'm very mindful of that we have to be aware that there are a lot of people who are going to go through a very tough time. So I do think that there is a case for this type of legislation, although we've said in the media already we're pretty concerned about some of the implications, and we're absolutely committed to make sure that it has a two-year expiry limit, and then during that period of time we can work on the other projects that are coming through behind this first wave.
And I saw that before obviously these changes there were criticisms and issues with the RMA, so you know, in regards to lack of clarity, lack of communication, and that it doesn't adequately protect enough those environmental interests. So are we going to see reforms, you know, changing for the better?
Yeah, we are. And actually, you know, one of the issues here is that David Parker has been leading a comprehensive review program of the RMA for the last 2 years. And it's a really good review. They're actually going right back to first principles and saying, what would a regulatory system look like that both had better outcomes for the environment than the RMA, but also was a simpler and faster system for planning purposes? Because, you know, we do have a problem with the RMA that it does take an incredibly long time to sort of get projects, you know, of any significance through the process and through the system. And so that is a really good piece of work, and we don't want to throw that out. And, you know, I think I can't remember exactly what the time frame is, but I think he was looking at introducing a significant package of reforms towards the end of the year.
But yeah, interesting to see. Final question. You mentioned, yeah, supporting people getting back into their jobs. But in the same line, you know, are we seeing pressure from employers during Alert Level 3 to push employees to go to work before they're ready, or they themselves feel vulnerable?
Yes, we have seen that, and we've been, you know, as clear as we can, that this is not an excuse to contravene employment law. and in fact, that, you know, the government's sort of wage subsidy programs and the things that we're doing to support businesses through this crisis are all there. And, you know, right from the very early stages of it, we said, look, you know, the support is here to help you, to support your employees, to be able to stay at home where they can. And you know, no system's perfect, right? And there are things that slip through the cracks. But if people are being pressured into doing things that their employment contracts don't allow for, then they should push back on that.
That was Green Party co-leader James Shaw. I think there are some very valid questions and suggestions coming from the Human Rights Commission, especially in times of crisis and emergency. Foundational, important partnership relationship between the Crown and Tangata Whenua should continuously be upheld. I'm also sure you've heard Jacinda call Alert 3 as lockdown but with takeaways, and it's really great to see people being able to get back into work where it's safe, where it's possible, and keeping physical distancing. However, I'm going to be looking into instances where employers or landlords are placing unnecessary pressure on employees or businesses to get back up and starting, especially those who are part of our vulnerable community. So if you are affected or you know someone who is being affected by this, do reach out. And yes.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire.